Kraut Fuzz behind us right now. Brand new one from them called Fuzz Kraut 19-2. 37 minutes left in this track, so we only got to hear an excerpt from it. We last complete song we heard there was Flory from their 2021 12XU release, Big Fall, the song Everyone, I Love You. Before that, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young from their 1970 Atlantic release, Deja Vu, Everybody, I Love You. Kraut Fuzz, doing Fuzz Kraut 19-2. Imminent release on Mirror World. That's what's behind us right now. Sun Custo from Imaginary Girls on Fuzzy Warbles gave us Nobel. Young Woo from 1987. Shore Leave, that's when Feely's stuck Dave Weckerman up front. And Eternal Ice, the name of the song we heard. Originally out on Coyote, reissued by Bar None in 2018. Thinking Fellers Union Local 282, reissue of Funeral Pudding from 1994. We heard Flames Up. Long before that, new music, The Swan Keeper. We heard Everlasting Nothingness. And at the top of the set, Erasurata doing French Canadia from 2001's Other Animals. My name is Scott, and I look forward to seeing you next week, friends. Do stay tuned. Mark Hurst's Tectonic is coming right your way, right here on Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City, and Rockland County at 91.9 FM. Worldwide online at WFMU.org. Bye.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the next hour. Thanks so much for joining. The title for today's show is Milestones for Big Tech and Tectonic. It's a show about milestones, and I'm going to start with the milestone for Tectonic because it's good news, and I don't always start on good news, but we're going to do that today. The milestone is that this is the 8th anniversary. This marks 8 years of Tectonic. The show started in September of 2017, and I'm just very pleased and I feel so privileged to be continuing the show for you and with you these 8 years later. This is episode number 377 that I have hosted. That doesn't count several guest host episodes along the way, and I appreciate all the guest hosts who've helped me. But this is 377 episodes, counting today's show. And when I started the show, I had this seed of an idea that's really developed over the years that I wanted to tell you the truth about what was happening in technology. I had some experience in the tech industry. I had a view onto what was happening, and I had a gut sense of what was going to happen. And I wanted to tell you, and I wanted to warn you, really, because I saw some very bad things on the horizon that were coming. And to a lot of people, I think these predictions of mine sounded a little strange, maybe a little conspiratorial, but they no longer sound like that. I've heard from people in the last year or two saying, everything that you said came true, which, you know, is a bit of an exaggeration, not everything, of course, but I think the general shape of what I saw, and not just me, other people on my spread out team of tech critics out there, we all saw this coming, that big tech was turning abusive and exploitative and was growing and concentrating its power. And we had a sense that bad things were in store, and so they were. I did not guess that they would get quite as bad as they have gotten, and I'm going to get to that soon. But there's another piece of good news, which I want to add before I move on to the other milestones, which is that the show has grown. Of course, it's grown in listenership from the very beginning, and I appreciate everyone who has come along for the ride, no matter when you started listening. Maybe today's your very first show, or maybe you've been listening from near or at the beginning, and I appreciate everyone's attention. The other area of growth is that we now have a number of radio stations around the world that are carrying Tectonic week to week. There are now 32 stations that are carrying Tectonic, and that's mostly in North America, and there are 2 in Europe, one in the Netherlands and one in Leipzig, Germany. And I'm humbled, and I am so appreciative of all of the independent community stations that are making time for Tectonic week to week in order to broadcast these messages, both from me, but maybe more importantly from all of my guests, to the listening audience in all those places. So from wherever you're listening from one of those stations or from an online archive or the podcast version of Tectonic, thank you for being with me. And I'm looking forward to where we go from here. By the way, if you have any comments, questions, suggestions, as always, you can reach me by email. I'm at mark@wfmu.org. That's mark@wfmu.org. And the website for Tectonic, as always, is tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, where you can learn more about the show and listen to past episodes, get a link to the podcast, and explore if that is what you want to do. So that's the milestone. Thanks again for everybody who has been with me and has sent messages of encouragement and suggestion over the years. And thus completes the good news section of the show. Sometimes I like to finish the show on good news, but today I'm starting it because there is some disappointing news. That's a charitable way of putting it that I need to impart to you, because there is another milestone that we crossed recently that is calling out for broadcast to you and beyond. I wish everybody knew where we were headed based on the recent news coming out of big tech. And I want to start by talking about the result of the giant antitrust trial against Google. Now, Google had been determined legally to be a monopoly in search. No surprise to anyone, least of all inside Google. Everybody knows that Google is a monopoly, has a monopoly in search. And more to the point, they're able to use their monopoly on search to surveil everyone within an inch of their lives, and then use that data, use those secret dossiers to monetize those in ways that are opaque to the people being surveilled. And that asymmetry of power is just, it's wrong. And yet it has continued. In fact, Google, knowing that people are not going to switch to competitors, has actually degraded the quality of Google search in recent years. Google search is getting worse and worse because they've figured out that if they make it worse, people are going to stay on Google longer and thus generate more profits with more engagement. And what are you going to do about it? You're going to use something other than Google? And just to make sure that people don't leave the severely degraded surveillance center that is Google search, Google bribes Apple. Yes, Apple gladly accepts this payment on the order of $20 billion a year. That's billion with a B, in order to remain the default search engine on iPhones. And on Apple devices, when you do a search, unless you can find the menu somewhere and change it to, I don't know, Brave or DuckDuckGo or Kagi or whatever the options are, most people don't even know about that. Unless someone seeks that out, they're going to continue to use Google. They're going to continue to give up their data outside of their knowledge or consent to Google. And Apple is happy to provide people, to provide Google with that extra surveillance data because Google bribed them with $20 billion payment. You got to think, if Google was really that good, do you think they would have to bribe Apple tens of billions of dollars a year to continue their lockdown of people, of users coming in on those Apple devices? Of course not. Google knows it's providing a worse and worse experience for people. That's why they're paying to maintain their monopoly. So all of this has been public knowledge for some time. And as I say, there was an official ruling. Google is legally a monopoly. I think I mentioned it on the show a while back. And so the remaining question was, what is the sentence going to be? Or in this case, the actual term is remedy. The term is remedy, referring to what Google is going to have to do to remedy its monopoly. And there were a number of options. The court could have said, and people thought some or all of these might be laid onto Google. One could have been, you got to stop bribing Apple. That's now outlawed. You can't pay Apple $20 billion a year to maintain your monopoly. Or you can't have Chrome, which is the web browser that most people use. That's a Google spyware operation. You should not be using Google Chrome if you can help it, but most people do in the same way that they use Google search. The court could have said, you got to spin off Chrome as its own company. And in other words, just a very mild breakup of the Google empire, just splitting off Chrome. Or they could have said the same for Android, which is the spyware that Google surveillance devices use as their operating system. You've heard about Android phones, that spyware made by Google in order to surveil you within an inch of your life outside of your knowledge or consent. The court could have said Google no longer has control over Android. There were other things that the court could have said. And instead, let me just read you what our recent guest, friend of the show, Cory Doctorow, wrote on September 3rd, 2025. Cory wrote a column called "The Worst Possible Antitrust Outcome." And he's writing about the judge who decided on the remedy, Judge Amit Mehta. And that's Mehta, M-E-H-T-A. It's not the Facebook Meta company that is the Zuckerberg empire. It just happens to be a similar sounding name. Here's what Cory writes. Judge Amit Mehta decided that the Google case should be shrouded in mystery, suppressing the publication of key exhibits and banning phones, cameras, and laptops from the courtroom, with the effect that virtually no one even noticed that the most important antitrust case in tech history, a genuine trial of the century, was underway. And I'll just add, that is true. If you go around to people and you ask them, did you hear what happened in the Google antitrust case? A lot of people will tell you, I didn't even know there was a case. That was partly because of this decision. I don't know why the judge decided for this decision or this sort of design, but the effect was, as Cory said, that the what happened during the trial was unknown to the public because it was basically a secret set of hearings. It was a secret process. There were no recording devices. That's why we didn't hear volumes of reporting from the media every day showing what Google's documents were revealing about the company and its behavior. Here's Cory again. Judge Mehta turned his courtroom into a star chamber, a black hole, whence no embarrassing information about Google's wicked deeds could emerge. That meant that the only punishment Google would have to bear from this trial would come after the government won its case, when the judge decided on a punishment, the term of art is remedy, for Google. So that set it up. Already, by the time Judge Mehta announced the remedy, huge opportunities were already lost because people did not have access to the proceedings inside the courtroom. So then he asked, well, what was the remedy after all of this? And Matt Stoller, who writes the big newsletter about antitrust, has done good work for years covering monopolies in all sorts of industries, not just tech, but he covered a lot on the Google antitrust trial. He wrote, very simply, this decision isn't just bad, it's virtually a statement that crime pays. So what was the decision after all? Let me read a little more from Cory Doctorow's column. He says, let's start with what's not in the remedy. Google will not be forced to sell off any of its divisions, not Chrome, not Android, despite the fact that the judge found that Google's vertical integration with the world's dominant mobile operating system and browser were a key factor in its monopolization. The judge decided to leave the Google octopus with all its limbs intact. In other words, Google does not have to break off Chrome. It does not have to break off Android. It gets to keep both of those inside the monopoly. Google also won't be forced to offer users a choice screen when they set up their Android accounts to give browsers other than Chrome a fair shake. Nor will Google be prevented from bribing competitors to stay out of the search market. One of the facts established in the verdict was that Google had been slipping Apple more than $20 billion a year, in exchange for which Apple forbore from making a competing search engine. This exposed every Safari user and every iOS user to Google surveillance while insulating Google from the threat of an Apple competitor. So basically, all of those possible remedies that I was listing to you before, Judge Mehta did not impose any of them on Google. And that's why Matt Stoller says, basically, the conclusion is crime pays. You're a monopoly. Well, keep doing it. You know, there's no ramifications, no outcomes, there's no consequences for criminal behavior on the part of monopolies that are surveilling and controlling the economy at this point. These are multi-trillion dollar companies that are dominating their industries to an extent with a concentration of wealth and power that we have never seen before ever in this country. And the official ruling is, it's okay, go for it. And I looked at that and I thought, that is a real line that we have crossed, that the oligarchy has achieved a kind of escape velocity when the courts can no longer hold them to any consequences. Now, yes, it's possible the Department of Justice could appeal this. It could go to the Supreme Court. You can fill in the blank on whatever you think the Supreme Court might do in this sort of environment. I'm not going to get any further into that. But whether it goes to the Supreme Court or not, it's going to take years. And even then, it may not have teeth. So we're stuck with Google's monopoly, and it's going to get even stronger. That is my prediction, because why wouldn't it? It's unchecked, and they know they have carte blanche at this point. As Brian Merchant, past guest on the show, wrote, one of the last best hopes for saving the open web and a free press is dead. He writes, breaking Google up was one of the last best hopes for preventing the free press from getting squeezed into oblivion and harvested into AI slop, and for saving the open web. The ruling that effectively lets Google continue operating as a monopoly isn't just disappointing, it's a disaster. And that's where we are, friends. The line that has been crossed has some of the smartest people who cover this topic saying, this is disastrous. This is criminal. And that is a milestone. Let me read you one other excerpt on this. This is from Jonathan Cantor, who was Assistant Attorney General for the Antitrust Division inside the Department of Justice from 2021 to 2024. He just wrote a piece in the New York Times. This is from September 7, 2025. By the way, there are links to all of these. And for this Times piece by Jonathan Cantor, there's a gift link. All of it's on the playlist, which you can find at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Just click the playlist link for the Milestones episode. This piece is called Why Google Got Off Easy. Cantor writes, my disappointment is not just that Google was not properly held accountable, because the stakes extend beyond this particular case. If companies can flout the rules, reap trillions of dollars, and face only modest constraints, the deterrent effect evaporates. The message to other companies is plain. It pays to break the law. At a time when authoritarian power is on the rise, we must not forget that plutocracy is also its own kind of dictatorship. That is the danger when we fail to enforce antitrust laws with clarity and conviction, that enormous concentrations of wealth will have too much influence over our lives. And this is me now again, that I thought Cantor expressed it perfectly. What's at stake here is not simply, is one monopoly going to be constrained? Are we going to do the right thing, the ethical thing, to undo some of the ongoing harms of this one company? Of course we should do that. It's so obvious that we should have imposed these remedies, all of them, and more, onto Google. It's so obvious. But Cantor is rightly saying that what's at stake is not simply one company doing the ethical thing on one company. What's at stake is whether we want the plutocracy, this tiny group of people who hold an incredible amount of wealth and power, to grow their power unchecked in their increasingly close partnership with an authoritarian government that's on the rise. And I'm gonna be diving more into that later in this show. I just want to set it up that Cantor called it, that there is a darker and more threatening possibility that is represented by this milestone, which is a much closer cooperation between the plutocrats and the authoritarians. That's what's at stake. And that's why I say, I wanted to give you the good news at the beginning of the show, because this is very, very bad news. Unless you happen to be one of the eight dudes on the West Coast who's who's got more money than he can spend in 100 lifetimes, unless you're one of those eight dudes or one of the clerisy that are working directly under one of those eight dudes, unless you're one of that tiny, tiny group out there in Northern California and Washington State, you're threatened by this. You and your family, your community are threatened by this. And by the way, I'm not only speaking to Americans here. Wherever you're listening to me from, you're threatened by this, this partnership. I want to read you a little bit more from Jonathan Cantor. I thought he said it so well. Last year, he writes, after years of grueling litigation, the same court ruled that Google illegally monopolized online search. For those of us who believe in vigorous antitrust enforcement, it was a breakthrough. At long last, the court confirmed what law enforcement, rival companies, and consumers long suspected. Google had abused its dominance to snuff out competition. The court's ruling, this is the one before the recent one, validated the simple truth that antitrust law applies as forcefully to today's Silicon Valley giants as it once did to the robber barons of steel and rail. He's speaking about the Gilded Age 100 years ago. Cantor continues, the court's remedy was supposed to translate that victory into accountability. But Tuesday's ruling, which requires that Google share its search results and some other data with rival companies, fell short. The court declined to order Google to divest its Chrome browser. Puzzlingly, it even permitted Google to keep paying billions of dollars each year to rivals like Apple to make Google search the default choice on their devices, even though that was the very tactic that Google used to illegally cement its dominance. So again, friends, we're seeing, I don't know how else to put it. This is a travesty of justice. It is so obvious that illegal activity is happening there. It's so obvious what the harms are to the economy, to society, to democracy. It's so obvious. And yet, we can't get any consequences to stick onto these guys. It's really frustrating. And beyond any feelings of frustration or irritation on my part, you know, my feelings don't really matter. What matters are the outcomes that we are all going to face for a generation or more because of this oligarchy. This is a really dark moment. There's another past guest who wrote something I thought very pertinent and trenchant. Alan Jacobs, August 28, 2025, wrote a column about the business model of these AI companies. And I could go further into that, but just on this point of big tech and its evils. Alan Jacobs, I thought, had a very thoughtful point. He writes, I sometimes ask family and friends, what would the big tech companies have to do? How evil would they have to become to get the public to abandon them? And I think the answer is, they can do anything they want, and almost no one will turn aside. And I'm sorry, friends, that I have to agree with Alan. I mean, just on a practical matter. We've known about Google's evil behavior for a number of years now. I've been talking about this. Now it makes 8 years. 8 years. And what have the consequences been to Google? What have the outcomes been of 377 shows? Google has gotten richer and richer and more powerful and more powerful. And more people are using Google products and locked into, as they say, the Google ecosystem. If you can call a web of surveillance malware in imbued with toxic sludge, if you can call that an ecosystem. And I think Alan Jacobs is right. It's just not a priority for most people to get themselves off of these evil big tech platforms. And by the way, let me be clear. I don't say that to shame anyone who's using these devices. I understand people are dealing with a lot of challenges in their lives and in this economy right now. I do not blame them. I blame the most powerful people in the economy, who are the leaders and senior executives of Google and Apple and Facebook Meta and Amazon and OpenAI and Uber and all of the rest of them and Microsoft and the rest. Those are who I blame, because they have the power to do something better and they choose not to. And that brings me to another milestone. See, friends, I thought that I would spend today giving you the good news about the 8-year anniversary and then countering that with the bad news about the Google antitrust trial as a milestone in the growth and the lockdown of the power by the oligarchy and their partnership with the authoritarians. And I would then maybe shift into some more good news at the end of the show, and that would be the show. And it turns out, I'm very sorry to say, again, I'm sorry to say that the Google antitrust trial was not the worst tech news of the week. Because then came the billionaire's dinner at the White House. And here I need to play, just to set it up, I need to play just a little bit of the song Thank You by Charlotte Edidjeri and Bolas Pupil. I really like this song. Why don't we start this up? And I'm going to come back and tell you why I'm playing this song.
No, 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 really, thank you. I am humbled by your presence. I feel honored to be part of this. I really appreciate this. I feel so blessed. Thank you. Amazing. Thank you. Thank you.
All right, so that's a little bit of Thank You by Charlotte and Bolas. And I'll just give you a preview. That's going to be our outro song for today. So don't worry, you're going to get to hear the whole song, or at least some of it, by the end of the show. And the reason I'm playing this, well, you'll hear, because there were some, I can't call them heartfelt necessarily, but there were some effusively delivered thank yous at a dinner at the White House held on Thursday, September 4, 2025. And the attendees, there were about, I think, two dozen or a few more attendees at this dinner. But most of those eight dudes that I talk about use as a placeholder for the tech oligarchs, most of them were there in attendance. I want to play a little bit of the footage. The current occupant was in the service of the ongoing tawdry reality TV show that he has made of the office of president. He made sure that there were cameras rolling as he asked the big tech CEOs to give him some praise and thanksgiving. And I want to play a clip for you. This is just a super cut of, of the big tech CEO's excerpts of some of their comments to the current occupant. And let me tell you who you're going to hear. In order, you're going to hear Bill Gates, who's, of course, the founder or co-founder of Microsoft, Tim Cook, who's the CEO of Apple, Safra Catz, who is the CEO of Oracle, who has worked with the current occupant in the past on a transition team, OpenAI CEO Sam Altman, followed by Sergey Brin, co-founder of Google, also known as Alphabet, Sundar Pichai, who is the current CEO of Google, and finishing up with a repeat appearance from none other than Mark Zuckerberg, CEO, founder of the Toxic Sludge Factory. Oh, that's also known as Facebook Meta. So why don't we hear what the big tech CEOs said to the current occupant when he went around the table asking them for their heartfelt comments. Let's Let's go ahead and hear them now.
Bill, would you like to say a few words?
Thank you for incredible leadership, including getting this group together.
Thank you, Bill. That is very nice.
I want to thank you for including me this evening. It's incredible to be among everyone here, particularly you and the First Lady. I've always enjoyed having dinner and interacting.
AI is going to change everything. You hear all of us saying that. But the fact that you are our president and you recognize this right away and you've unleashed American innovation and creativity.
Echo the comments of Tim and others. Thank you so much for getting us all together. And thank you for being such a pro-business, pro-innovation president. It's a very refreshing change.
I think it's a real incredible inflection point right now in AI. The fact that your administration is supporting our companies instead of fighting with them.
We look forward to working together, and thanks for your leadership.
Great job you're doing. Incredible, really, job. Would anybody like to say anything? You have a lot of geniuses on my right.
Well, thanks for hosting us. I mean, this is quite a group to get together. And, you know, I think, you know, all of the companies here are building, just making huge investments in the country in order to build out data centers and infrastructure to power the next wave of innovation. So it's... you know, we don't often get together as the CEOs of the different companies, but it's good to.
Yeah, this is really good exposure for us. And exposure should have a price, right?
Yeah, so great exposure for us. Thank you. This is incredible. Oh, the innovation. Oh, the leadership. Oh, it's so great to be here. Oh, I love what you're doing. Those are your big tech CEOs, friends. You heard them. It's not just me pointing this out. There is a lot of coverage of that dinner. Here's Wired from September 5, 2025, a piece called All the President's Tech CEOs. Quote, at a White House dinner Thursday night, America's tech executives put on an uncanny display of fealty to, I'll just say, the current occupant. The current occupant loves a banquet, which presumably means he loves a seating chart. Zuckerberg sat directly to his right, while Gates scored a chair next to Melania on the left. Sergey Brin and his, quote, really wonderful MAGA girlfriend, the current occupant's words, Geraldine Gilbert Soto, sat directly across from the president. Gilbert Soto, I'm going to say more about that. So here we have the press, thankfully, covering the words of the big tech CEOs around the dinner table. And because there were live mics and there were cameras, they picked up on another interesting exchange involving Mark Zuckerberg. And I'm going to play this raw footage for you, and it's a little bit hard. There was a lot of crosstalk, so it's hard to hear exactly what's happening, but I'm going to interpret it for you afterwards. So let me play you this. This is, I guess, during dinner. This is the current occupant speaking with Mark Zuckerberg.
How much are you spending, would you say, over the next few years?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think it's probably going to be something like, I don't know, at least $600 billion through 28 in the U.S. Yeah.
It's a lot.
No, it's significant.
That's a lot. Thank you, Mark. It's great to have you.
Sorry, I wasn't ready to do our announcement.
He said I wasn't sure what number you wanted.
Okay, you couldn't hear it, but it's hard to hear from that footage, but... After the current occupant asks Zuck, how much are you investing? Meaning, how much do you promise to invest in this great country, I guess? Zuck is just searching for a number, and he goes, I guess $600 billion. And then later, while everyone is eating, Zuck leans over to the current occupant and says, basically, I didn't know what number you wanted me to go with. So here you have one of the richest, most powerful people in the world telling the current occupant that he brought a number out of thin air in order to satisfy the current occupant and his need to say something in front of the cameras. This is what Mike Brock wrote about this from September 7, a great piece called The Hot Mic and the Monsters. This is also on the playlist, by the way, at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. Brock wrote this as a follow-up to the oligarch's dinner party, as he put it. He writes, Zuck announced that Meta would invest $600 billion in American AI infrastructure, a figure so astronomically absurd that it would require borrowing more than twice the company's total book value. The CEO of a publicly traded company just admitted on live microphone that he fabricates financial projections based on whatever pleases the dear leader. Securities law and shareholder responsibilities be damned. These are the wealthiest people in the history of humanity, sitting in the court of the most corrupt man to ever hold the office of the presidency, casually making up numbers to placate a public they view as sheep, while the regime they ingratiate themselves with engages in extrajudicial killings of suspected drug traffickers, plans military occupations of American cities that don't bend the knee, and oversees an era of extractive capitalism that makes the robber barons look restrained. The hot mic didn't just catch Zuckerberg lying, it caught him revealing the fundamental relationship between oligarchy and authoritarianism in our time. Power serves wealth, truth serves power, and human dignity becomes an inefficiency to be optimized away by people who've forgotten what dignity means. Just reading that out loud, friends, it underlines the depravity of the so-called leadership class that we have in this country. The asymmetry of power between the oligarchs and the rest of us. And let me tell you, friends, I've said it before, the fight ahead of us is not about the two-party system that some of us who grew up in the U.S. grew up being used to. Oh, it's the Republicans versus the Democrats or whatever. And I know one party has fallen under the sway of the current occupant. I get that. But I mean, the parties as we traditionally understood them, one a little left, one a little right, this the fight ahead of us has nothing to do with that. The game has totally changed. The new fight is between the oligarchs and the rest of us. The fight isn't left versus right. It's about big tech versus you and your community. It's between the big tech CEOs and me and you. That's the fight ahead of us. And you want to know what side they're on? They just told you. Just listen to them. Oh, thank you. Oh, thank you. This is so great. They said it. The cameras were rolling. They knew the mics were live and they said it. Just remember when the next little gadget comes out and they say, oh, we're your friends. Oh, we're going to liberate you. Oh, isn't this so innovative? You just remember what side they're on because they told you already. And just 2 days later, I found this so interesting. 2 days after that oligarch dinner with all of them fawning over the dear leader. Oh, you're so wonderful. There was a very different display, and I was so proud to see this. There was a protest in downtown Washington, D.C. It was put on by a group called We Are All D.C., although the participants weren't all from that group. I think there were many different groups that came out into the streets to protest the militarization of this city. And there were thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people. You can go online. There's a link on the playlist at tectonic.fm, you can look into this yourself. You can see the footage. Try to gauge for yourself how many people were there. The streets were flooded with people who came out on Saturday in order to show their displeasure, their opposition to the absurd, ridiculous shows of military power in American cities. And this is what it sounded like. I have some footage for you. That's the Free DC. We are all DC protests. They're chanting Free DC, Free DC. And I don't mean to spotlight this one protest as it's the unique occurrence. There are protests against the current occupant and his policies in many cities for many different reasons. I spotlight this one simply because it was less than 48 hours after the oligarchs, the big tech oligarchs, had declared their fealty to the leader, the dear leader, the current occupant, who had sent the military into their streets. And that difference between the dinner party, oh, thank you, and the citizens 2 days later, Free DC, Free DC, is a perfect encapsulation of the fight ahead of us. It's them against us. And don't ever trust a word out of their mouths after this, because they have told you where their fealty lies. You heard it. As for me, I'm with the people that are opposed to the big tech oligarchs. Count me on their side. And good job to everyone who filled the streets of D.C. And thank you in advance to everyone who follows them in the cities to come that are going to be organizing protests. The fight ahead is between big tech and their plutocrats and their cooperation with the authoritarians versus the rest of us. That's the fight. We can get to left-right quibbles after this, when this is all done. But right now, there's a concentration of power in this country and, by extension, in the economy at large in the world that cannot stand. This is an incredibly dangerous time. I thought the Google antitrust battle was disappointing, but this is truly chilling. And I don't know where we go from here. Because the closer you look into the ideologies and the words and the behavior of these individuals on the plutocrats team, the stranger and more disturbing it gets. And here I want to return to that oligarch's dinner. And I told you that Google co-founder Sergey Brin was there, and the current occupant was praising his girlfriend, this woman Geraldine Gilbert Soto, as, quote, Brin's really wonderful MAGA girlfriend. And I want to play you that moment when the current occupant said those words and what she herself said in response. So here is Geraldine Gilbert Soto, and Sergey Brin has a few words as well for the current occupant.
And Sergey, you were saying a lot in the Oval Office. I figured you're somebody that likes to speak with his really wonderful MAGA girlfriend. So would you like to say a few words?
Well, babe, do you want to say something?
I truly, every time I'm here or in your presence, I'm so grateful. So thank you. It's like,
thank you.
I can't believe it. Every time, like the inauguration here, I think you're doing amazing work.
Thank you very much.
We actually were just with...
Leopold. Should I mention? He's in Venezuela.
And you're
applying a lot of pressure to Maduro. And I think that's phenomenal.
Okay, so again, thank you. Phenomenal. The last words came from Sergey Brin, co-founder of Google. And this I got from the Wired article, again, called All the President's Tech CEOs from September 5, 2025. And again, Wired pointed out that Sergey Brin and his really wonderful MAGA girlfriend, Geraldine Gilbert Soto, sat directly across from the current occupant. And Wired continues, Gilbert Soto comes by that praise honestly. In addition to being an ardent supporter of the current occupant online, she has posted on Twitter/X that... Well, I'm going to have to read this post on Twitter, what we now are supposed to call X. This is from September 3rd, 2025. There's a screenshot of this post on the playlist at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, because it's hard, just hard, like I said, this gets stranger and stranger. This is what Geraldine Soto posted on September 3rd, quote, "Is Burning Man evil? Well, yeah, obviously. been saying that for years. It's very clearly rooted in paganism, but so is everything else. Halloween, Christmas, our government, literally everything. This world is a spiritual battlefield built on pagan roots, and you can't escape it. All that matters is your personal relationship with God and how you navigate through the deception. Unquote. Okay, so that is Sergey Brin's girlfriend, the same who was at the oligarch's dinner, sitting across from the current occupant, who was gushing about just being in his presence, who apparently, if she was writing this seriously in her post, believes that literally everything is very clearly rooted in paganism, and Burning Man is evil. And apparently so is Halloween, and so is Christmas, and so is our government. And you look at that and you go, so she's in a relationship with one of the most powerful people in the world who co-owns a monopoly that has been given carte blanche to do whatever it wants in its surveillance of the global population, as it has a chokehold on their search queries, emails, documents, and everything else, and who himself has professed his fealty to the current occupant, showing a greater desire to work even more closely with the authoritarian, presumably bringing his surveillance powers to bear against citizens like the ones who, less than 48 hours later, were in the streets protesting against the same dear leader for the unjust militarization of their city. And Christmas is evil, and literally the government too. What is going on here? What sort of people and what sort of beliefs are inside the minds and the hearts of the plutocrats who hold all of the money and power, at least online, that radiates outward to every other industry and aspect of life and work? It's weird. And I wish that this was just a one-off. And I don't mean to just spotlight Sergey's girlfriend, because I use that post as a data point because it's part of a pattern that I've noticed. Let me give you another data point. Peter Thiel, one of the most wealthy and powerful people in Silicon Valley and thus the world, owns Palantir, the surveillance platform that the U.S. government is increasingly using on a federal and state level to spy on our citizens and citizens elsewhere. Peter Thiel has influence in many places, not just Palantir. I should do a show just on Peter Thiel so we can cover the extent of his influence. But there was a very interesting story in Inc. magazine, September 3rd, 2025. And it asks a question, want to learn from Palantir co-founder Peter Thiel? And this is what the story says. Peter Thiel will be giving a four-part lecture series at the Commonwealth Club of San Francisco, and it's already sold out. So he hasn't given the lectures yet, but all the seats for all four lectures are already sold out. This is the Commonwealth Club, which, as I understand, is a very highly regarded institution in the Bay Area, where they have prominent intellectuals and authors and people come and give these erudite lectures and presentations about topics of interest. I didn't read you the entire quote. Let me read you the whole quote. Peter Thiel will be giving a four-part lecture series on the Antichrist. What? Yeah. Yeah, Peter Thiel, Silicon Valley VC, co-founder of the surveillance company Palantir, has a four-part sold-out lecture series at the Commonwealth Club about the biblical opponent of Jesus who appears in Revelation, the last book of the Bible, as time comes to an end and the world turns into Judgment Day or something like that. I'm giving you a very basic overview. Tell me again why Sergey Brin's girlfriend and Peter Thiel both are talking about cosmic powers of evil and the end of time and Christmas being wrong and literally everything and the government being pagan. What exactly is going on over in Silicon Valley? These are the people. This is the ideology that is taking shape over there in the minds and hearts of people who have more wealth and power than they know what to do with. And I mean that for seriously. When it came to Mark Zuckerberg, asked for a number out of thin air, he dutifully comes up with $600 billion, a number he can't possibly make good on, and then later apologizes because I didn't know what number you wanted to come up with. Let me ask you a question, friends. What use is it to be a billionaire if you can't do something good? What use is it to have all of that money and power if you're not going to deploy it for something good in the world? Why choose to use your time on earth to serve the authoritarian, to continue the chokehold on your monopoly that abuses people and degrades service and spies on them and partners with who knows what sort of agency and institution and shady third party, and we don't even know what's to come? That's the truly scary thing about this, is that I can tell you now what just happened in the Google antitrust trial and what just happened at the oligarchs' dinner and the brief good news we had in the streets of D.C. I can tell you about the battle lines that are being drawn, but I cannot tell you where we go from here. My gut says it's really bad. But given that we have incredibly powerful people that have no check on their power, on their influence, and in their behavior right now in this moment, they're showing no tendency to turn toward the ethical, to turn toward the good, it leaves me with a very apprehensive feeling in the pit of my stomach. That's the milestone that big tech has shown itself with this week. And I'm afraid that 8 years of tectonic does not counteract that. I don't even know that we, friends, have made a blip of difference. But at least we're here together and we have a space to discuss these things. And I appreciate the opportunity to try to tell you what I believe is the truth here at WFMU and here on Independent Radio. Thanks again to all the stations that are airing this show. And I'm hoping to be with you for much longer. We'll see. I'm going to do my best. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County, and 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Until next time, friends, a little bit of homework. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And as promised, let's go out to Thank You by Charlotte Edigeri and Bolas Pupil. Thank you. Seriously, for being with me today. I'll see you next time.
For taking the time to tell me this. This is a real eye-opener. Yeah, you're right. This doesn't look good on me. And maybe I should ditch the blonde wig. That's such a good idea. Tell me, what would you like to see me in then? Couldn't have done this before. without you and your opinion. Enlighten me with your vision. I count my blessings. Yes, I prefer my first EP too. Yeah, maybe I should make it less complex. Two projects, one artist, geez. What the hell was I even thinking? My inspiration comes from you. Oh, what an honor. I am not worthy of your kindness, noble intentions. Thank you so much for this opportunity. Yeah, this is really good exposure for us. And exposure shouldn't have a price, right? Because money doesn't rhyme with creativity. Couldn't have done this without you and your opinion. Enlighten me with your vision. I count my blessings.
And good evening. Sorry about the very rude, very disturbing transition from the sweet song tune that Mark's show ended with. I think you can take it. Anyway, good evening and welcome to another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music is what we call it. My name is Dave Mandel. I host this show. I'm here every Monday between the hours of 7 and 8 p.m. here on the East Coast, and always a complete pleasure, complete total pleasure to be here playing for music for you every week. And I should mention, I'll talk more about it later, there's not much to say, frankly, but our new schedule went into effect today. The WFMU fall-winter schedule started today, so there are going to be various changes. There have been various changes on the schedule. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. But go to our website and check it out. This show remains in its current slot. I'm very happy about that. Here, still here Monday evenings at 7. We're going to begin tonight's show musically with a group called Baroness. They are from Savannah, Georgia. And we're going to hear a track from a 2007 release that was called Red Album. And is that a King Crimson reference? Possibly. Or possibly not. We're going to hear a track from that album called Waiting Wintry Wind. I remembered it was WWW. I didn't remember what it stood for. Wailing Wintry Wind, as a matter of fact, is the actual real title. Again, this is a group called Baroness. They're from Savannah. And this is what they sound like. And that's something from the, that is something from the group Baroness. Again, they're from Savannah. And we heard a track from the album Red Album, released in 2007. A piece called Wailing.